in which the God of ages is to be enshrined, is to find his material sanctuary among men. This power of mind is variously represented in ancient philosophy, but I think that we consider in most cases that this power of mind is particularly centered in the egoism of man. It is this power of mind by which man ultimately discovered his own identity, his own self-existence. And by establishing his own self-existence, he made the discovery that he was somewhere between heaven and earth. He had outgrown the earth, but he had not yet reached heaven. And he conceived, therefore, of a ladder uniting heaven and earth, the same ladder or the type of ladder that we find in the story of Jacob and his dream. This ladder was one upon which living beings ascend and descend. This ladder was the orbits of the seven planets that extended upward from the surface of the earth to the inner surface of the firmament or the empyrean. And these seven orbits were the abodes of seven cosmocrators or deities of creation. They were the ones who molded matter. They were the tyrants, the gods of old. They were the jealous gods of ancient nations and races. They were the ones that, moving about the earth, sought and accomplished the organization of the earth. Among them, according to the Olympian hierarchy, the parts of the world were divided and distributed. They were given their kingdoms, their temples, their sanctuaries. From them, the ancient Hindus say, came forth the continents and the races and the nations, each under the rulership of its own particular deity. But these deities in themselves simply represent the specializations of the seven powers of the mind, moving relentlessly but magnificently, ultimately, to become the seven powers of the soul. Now this transformation of these seven, as first appearing, focusing their energies upon matter to produce creation, and finally becoming seven doors through which creation escapes back into a spiritual state. This strange difference, the descending and ascending powers of these planetary arcs or arches, are represented through the involutionary and evolutionary motions of energy. So in the initiation rites of ancient man, we find this set forth in such symbolism as the hymn of the robe of glory. We see man as a spirit, man as a divine being, a part of God. We find him descending in some systems voluntarily and in others involuntarily, but always that he is descending through the seven orbits of the planets, as he descended through the royal arches of Enoch, to come finally to the earth, and there to go to sleep in matter, and there to remain asleep for a certain time, and finally to awaken from this sleep as an infant, to pass through the seven ages, which constitute physical life, and the seven stages, which represent the seven degrees of spiritual evolution. We find, therefore, that these levels or stages or degrees are related to the seven churches which are in Asia, and the seven golden rungs of the ladder that fell from heaven so that Muhammad could ascend through the gates of the empyrean. Man, then, has this sevenfold mystery within himself. He is ascending through seven stages of consciousness, and he is returning gradually to the empyrean or to the heavenly state from which he came. He ascends through his own growth, through his own disciplines, and through the perfections of arts and sciences, for every labor that he performs is part of the septenary. Every degree of growth which he attains is part of it. His evolution through races, his evolution through religions, cultures, through great epics in history, all these turn back upon the septenary, and all parts can be measured and determined by the seven levels of the soul by which it ascends to the light from which it came. These are the seven souls of the ancient Gnostic doctrine and of the Egyptian teaching about immortality. So So we have man as a creature passing through an initiation ritual. He descends to the seven orbits, becomes locked in the abode of darkness, and then from darkness he reemerges. And in your doctrine of Neoplatonism, you find the seven steps of consciousness ascending from opinion through sense to knowledge and finally upward to illumination, which is again the perfection of the psychic life in man. Incidentally, and by all these points, it is curious that in the evolutionary process, it is not the personal life of man, but the psychic life which must be saved. It is not the individuality, but the universality in man which is important. And this must be brought ultimately and finally to its total liberation. So we have these orders of ancient planets. And we go back to our Greek system, and we find several things that are of great interest to us. In the Greek theology, for example, we find that originally the great God was called Heaven. And this God was called the Great Father God. And he was Uranus, the sky deity. And this sky deity ruled supreme for a great period of time. And then his kingdom was taken from him by Saturn. And Saturn, in turn, lost his kingdom to Zeus. And Zeus, in order to save his kingdom and to make possible its ultimate regeneration, fashioned in a mystery and carried in a golden thigh bone the mysterious infant child Zagreus, or Dionysus, who was to be the radiant personification of the god himself. This deity, Dionysus, was for the salvation of the world. Now let us see what this all means when we start to develop it. We see then that heaven, Uranus, losing its kingdom to Saturn, is the beginning of generation. This means the first orbit within the great mystery of the sky itself. Saturn was the ancient one, the old god, Cronus. And for some mysterious reason, the ancient named the outer orbit of the solar system in honor of this deity. Placed the symbol of Saturn as the sign of the ancient one, Cronus, or time, and made this god the devourer of his own children. And Saturn, in order to preserve his kingdom, destroyed his children by eating them as rapidly as they were born. But finally, the wife of Saturn substituted a stone for one of the children. And this deceiving the god, Zeus was permitted to live. And Zeus, in due time, took over the kingdom of his father and fulfilled the ancient prophecy that was written in space. The legend here is rather obvious. Saturn is time. Time devours its own children. It devours everything which is engendered within it. Nothing that is born in time or of time can survive time. Therefore, we have here a problem in substitution. By a subterfuge, something that was timeless was introduced into the pattern of time. And in this way, Saturn was outwitted to produce out of itself or from itself the deity Zeus or Jupiter. Now let us go for a moment and remember that our ancients were not concerned with mere physical phenomena. What did Saturn represent? Saturn represented to the ancients supreme wisdom. Saturn was the ancient power that must ultimately also devour everything less than itself. Therefore, all things that are born from wisdom must ultimately be devoured again by wisdom. This was the strange, abstract, contemplative wisdom of meditation. This was meditation from which things are born, but to which all things must return again. This was a kind of consciousness which engenders, but holding and possessing, always forces the thing which it has created to return to itself again and be dissolved. So Saturn, representing the beginning of creation, also becomes the symbol of death. For everything that is created must die. And everything that is born of the race of the Volsungs in the Nordic mysteries is destined to the tragedy of the Götterdämmerung. All the heroes of the world must die because they are the progeny of death. So anciently Saturn, or Cronus, was represented carrying the scythe of death, sometimes represented as the reaper, and often as an aged person, often as a skeleton. Saturn was then the devourer, the ultimate. Saturn was the beginning of motions, which in themselves must end. Saturn was the beginning of separation, which is itself the supreme illusion, and must lead ultimately to the end of its own existence. So Saturn plays many parts, often apparently in complete conflict with themselves, but always there is one underlying principle underneath, and that principle is that Saturn is strangely both beginning and end. Saturn is the hope and the end of hope. Saturn is death, and Saturn is everlasting life, depending upon the direction of the motions. For the ancients believed that from the rings of Saturn, souls were cast back into the empyrean or space. Saturn is the graveyard of all things, but it is destined, according to the Chinese, that all the earth shall someday be a graveyard. Everything that is mortal comes under the power of this Saturnian principle that is the absolute tyrant. And yet, by another mystery, one child escaped the destruction. One child could not be devoured by the god. And what was the symbol of this child? Why did Zeus survive? This is a very interesting and knotty problem in Greek philosophy and Greek metaphysics. But it seems that Saturn gave birth out of himself to one principle that could defeat himself. And the nature of this principle we have to find in the very processes of contemplation. For in the meditational mystery, there is in the state of illumination that power which can escape death, the power that is born of death but comes to eternal life. There is in the composition of all things that which is born but cannot die. This mystery is the mystery of the soul itself, for the soul is the only thing that has a beginning in time but an eternity of continuance. Such was the Greek concept, inasmuch as the soul, outgrowing the mystery of life, was alone capable of the experience of immortality. Zeus survived the strategy to destroy him, and in time became the master of the kingdom. Now Zeus at this stage represents the infantile aspect of the soul in its, in its potential, not in its potency. And Zeus becomes a kind of autocrat. Zeus becomes a very tyrannical thing. Because he is the symbol of imagination, and because he has to do with the dream of creation. And from Zeus, in his dreaming and in his mystery, there come forth certain principles and powers. And one of these principles or powers is the horn Zagros, which is carried within his father's thigh, the mother Semele having been destroyed by thunderbolts. And this horned deity is Mars. Now Mars, therefore, is the next in our order of descending planetary orbits from the sun, from the sphere of Saturn. And Zagros, in turn, is Mars, or the dynamic energy of the Titans, or the titanic powers which force the world into existence. And the power of Mars is the power of will. Therefore, out of the experience, out of the mystery of imagination, out of the creative potency of Zeus comes the symbol of will. Will as the directing force by means of which worlds are brought into manifestation and by which the objective life of man is maintained. But this Zagros passes through a metamorphosis, because will in itself is a very subtle thing, as Schopenhauer points out. And out of the mystery of will comes the alternative deity. For from Zagros comes forth Dionysus. And this change is accomplished without death or without the changing of personality. Zagros simply becomes Dionysus. And the means of this becoming is a metamorphosis so gradual and so systematic that it is almost impossible to determine the boundaries of the myth. Dionysus, of course, is the sun. So we find the solar system moving from the power of Mars to the power of the sun. Now the sun, therefore, becomes a kind of regeneration or redirection of the power of will. And out of will, the will of the creating factor of Zeus, the will born of heaven, comes this other kind of will, which Birmingham terms the divine will. The will of man, the will of nature, the will of the universe, to the achievement of the great spiritual mystery. The regeneration of will. The transformation of will from the force aspect to the compassion aspect. So that the great power to create things, to force things, to move things, is transformed from will to love. And love becomes a supreme power taking the place of will. And in this, Zeus gives his beloved son, transforming him from the will aspect to the love aspect. And as soon as this is achieved, Dionysus begins his great adventure, which leads to his final tragedy. For it is the inevitable tragedy of love that it must perish. And love, strangely enough, dies for its world, or dies into its world. And in the mystery of Dionysus and his adventures, we have the focal point of the human ego. Dionysus becomes also the human spiritual entity, born of will and perfected in love. A creature created by a fiat of power, but perfected by a renunciation of power. So Zagros and Dionysus become the polarities of will as power and love as redeeming power. Thus we have descended now through the four arches of the sky, the orbits of the planets Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, and the Sun. And we find the Sun placed midway in the septenary. This makes it possible for the sun to be the fourth from below and the fourth from above, constituting a point of mingling. The sun's location, then, corresponds almost exactly with the location of the heart and the human body suspended between the two great focal points of creation and generation, and also the middle ground of the soul or psychic field, and the sun or the ego, standing in the midst of itself, standing in the middle part of the great septenary of the soul sphere, has the right and has the power to extend its rays upward to the contemplations of causes, or to descend with its rays into the underworld to become involved in the mystery of effects. If the sun falls into the underworld, it is there for 3 degrees or 3 days buried. For it descends through the orbits of the 3 inferior planets and is finally placed within the earth, which is the underworld. And in turning further downward, this new power, this power which we call the compassion or love of God, falls next into its reflection or negative correspondent, becoming involved in the mystery of Venus, which is like the Venusberg and Tannhäuser, or Kundry in the Parseval cycle. For as the sun, blessed of its father and bearing its father's power of divine love, representing the ego, falls into the orbit of Venus, it falls into sensory or sensuous love. It falls into the personal out of the impersonal, for it is descending downward now into the mystery of illusion. And Venus is the guardian of the garden of illusion. And Venus represents the appetitive and emotional powers of the soul. Captured within these powers, held like Parsifal in an enchanted garden, the soul begins to substitute human emotion for divine emotion. Substitutes attachment to form for attachment to life. Substitutes the beautification of externals for the glorification of eternals. And so this great psychic entity falls into the orbit or sphere of Venus, who is the mistress of the oceans, born out of the sea, born out of Maya or the dream. This mysterious descent, according to the Greeks, was represented in their mystery rituals by a series of sensory temptations, which, unless the candidate could overcome them or withstand them, meant that he was led astray into the mystery of darkness. From this orbit, the psychic nature, falling into generation, and now we will say clothed with the emotional power of Venus, therefore with sensory appetite and emotion, falls then into the orbit of Mercury. And in the orbit of Mercury, another factor takes over. For Mercury is the symbol of the critical intellect. Mercury is the symbol of sensory perception, deriving its authority through the five senses. Thus, the objective sensory perceptions of man are represented by Mercury. They are the senses which are the messengers of the gods. They carry the sensory reflexes from the external world to man, and from man outward to the external world. But by now he is captured in the illusion. Therefore now, not only does the emotional nature tyrannize him, but also the intellective principle, in its negative polarity, Mercury, begins to burden him with opinion, divides him, creates criticism, sets him upon a division of learning, of attitudes, in which little by little the unities of knowledge are lost, so that Mercury makes him the critic rather than the knower. It makes him the intellectual rather than the wise person. And having become invested and involved, therefore, with the powers of the sensory illusions, the generating or incarnating soul falls into the orbit of the moon, which is the last before the actual embodiment or the final descent into matter. The orbit of the moon is the orbit of imagination. Imagination supported and sustained by sensory perception and the amatory principle of Venus closes in upon the individual, limiting the soul more and more to a kind of life that emerges only from within itself, or as the ancient Greeks said, placing man totally under the tyranny of his own interpretation of things. For imagination creates the world we live in. We do not live in a world as it is, we live in a world as it seems to us. Every neurosis, every bitterness, every defeat in our own nature colors our concept of the whole world. And as our own disillusionments increase, as our own vitality decreases, the world closes in upon us as a terrible or hateful thing. Imagination gives us false motivations, limits us and binds us constantly with the effects of our own inward imageries, drawing upon the darkening resources of our inner lives. In our slow descent, we come finally into the amazing and incredible condition that we no longer even are capable of seeing the world as it is, knowing the world even with the aid of the sensory perceptions, because everything that we see is instantly interpreted. Everything that we contact is distorted and deformed by our own imaging about it. Until we finally land in a kind of personal universe in which each individual creates his own world in spite of the world he lives in. And instead of being a citizen of the earth, he becomes only a partisan within his own tiny world. The world, perhaps, of himself alone, or of his family, or of a few limited ties, he loses complete sight of even the facts of the world around him, creating an imaginary series of facts that are valid only to himself, facts which are constantly subject to change because they are not real, because they have no foundation in abiding truth. And according to the Greeks, when this descending being reaches this point, it is coming very near and dangerously close to the final involvement. For the material world, which we call the earth, is surrounded by a kind of humid atmosphere. Thales was one who developed quite a philosophy of this humid atmosphere. But having reached downward now to the orbit of the moon, the soul is swept down into the humidity of the earth. And this humidity closes in upon it as water upon a drowning man. And once, as Heraclitus points out, that this humidity captures the descending being, it intoxicates it. And the peculiar fetid aroma of death, which is on the earth, the strange world earth, which is made of the rotting of things, as the ancients said, that as life crawled out of prehistoric slime and mud and the elos of the primordial sphere, so the earth itself is a strange kind of humid atmosphere, like that in a hothouse, where we have the smell of the earth and the strange steaminess of it. And the ancients said that this was a kind of atmosphere which, when the soul becomes immersed in it, acts like an intoxicating liquor. The soul becomes drunk or intoxicated, as we find in the myth of Cupid and Psyche, where Psyche, having been immersed in matter, can no longer walk straightly, but walks with a strange twisting motion, staggering about. This staggering of the soul in the humidity of the earth was said to lead it finally to the point where it drank the waters of Lethe and passed into total unconsciousness concerning its own nature or its own substance. And in this unconsciousness it is born into this world as a physical being, born unconscious. Not only born unconscious, but doomed to remain unconscious. Not only through the childhood and infancy, but into maturity and old age. Because consciousness, truly, must have escaped in some way from this humidity of earth. And if it does not escape, it is never able to express itself. Thus man, even in his maturity, carrying on the projects of his living, advances by staggering, advances in a strange circuitous route, advances like the crab, making one step forward and two sideways, never straight, because the soul is intoxicated by matter, and it wanders about, unable to extricate itself from the fumes and from the strange purgatorial mists that rise from the earth. Of course, this is the symbolic story as told in the mysteries, but the point of it is rather obvious, that the being, once enveloped and enmeshed in the substance of body, is locked within it, and being thus locked within it, struggles desperately to escape, but cannot find any way out of body. This was the beginning and end, essentially, of the doctrine of Socrates, was that man must discover a means of rescuing his own being from the strange humidity which we call ignorance. Ignorance being the strange property which intoxicates the soul when it enters into the sublunary sphere which we call the earth. So having brought the soul now downward in the mystery ritual, down the rungs of the ladder, we find man completely locked. Yet with all this locking, bearing within himself all the powers of the hierarchs from which he has fallen, also containing the mystery of the orbits of the planets through which he has descended. He has been locked by the seven deadly sins, or the negative poles of these planets. He must now unlock them by developing the seven cardinal virtues of the soul. He must ascend once more through the seven churches which are in Asia, and he must open the seven seals of Revelation, and he must learn to understand the Vedantic mystery of the opening of the seven chakras, or symbols of soul release, by which man ascends again into the abode from which he came. To make this ascent possible, the ancients say that institutions were set up in the world, and these institutions were in every case in some manner reminiscent of the universe. The temples of the ancient gods were built in the forms of constellations and of worlds, and the great forms that were used throughout were either the forms of man himself, representing in his structure, as Leonardo da Vinci points out, the measurements of the cosmos, or the great canon of rules by which the merits and values of all things may be estimated. Man himself, contemplating the productions of nature and the productions of art, is stimulated, according to the Greeks, by the dawn of memory. In other words, he must first of all activate the lower faculties of his own consciousness. From the moon he gained imagination. Imagination, by its abuse or misuse, cast him into matter, causing him to look downward, see his own reflection in the pool, and like Narcissus, perish trying to embrace the likeness of himself. But man ascending must ascend back through these orbits by transmuting each of the energies and making the destroying powers the redeemers. He is able to do this because within himself was placed the blood of Dionysus. He contains within himself the life of the solar mystery. And because he possesses this, he is potentially capable of overwhelming or overcoming the creatures that guard each sphere all the way back to the world from which he came. Man is greater than the angel. Man can escape because by nature, origin, and substance, he is superior to the thing in which he is captured. If man had been created in or differentiated from any one of those seven levels, he could not ascend above it. But because he was created above them all, he can be restored to his own natural destiny. Because he was enslaved rather than created, he can be liberated rather than annihilated. Thus, that which is within him, being superior to the world, cannot die with it, but can be rescued or separated from death by the mystery of the ascent of the ladder of the seven stars, the jewel of the seven stars of Egypt, the mysterious ladder rising from the tomb of the Egyptian priest, upon which, on the rounds of which, ascends the Bennu, or bird of the soul. So man's locked within matter, finding locked also within himself the seven lights of the candlestick, and the seven mysterious angels before the throne, he discovers that within him are the seven powers which imprisoned him, and each one of these powers, through cultivation, becomes a liberator. Therefore, man, to redeem himself, must redeem the seven powers of the planets. Thus, in the ancient alchemical mystery, the philosopher's stone was composed of the substance of the seven planetary metals, which, when properly brought together, or purified, or redeemed by rotations, as they were called, would ultimately produce the elixir of life, the philosopher's stone, and the universal medicine. So, coming back up, man discovers that imagination is to be now his leader. He must redeem imagination. And this redemption of imagination is perhaps one of the labors upon which man has worked from the earliest periods of history. He has been trying to use this strange formative power within him to ennoble rather than to destroy. He has sought to escape the pit that we are in today and make out of this neurotic instinct the great creative agent, the magical agent of liberation as Paracelsus described it. For imagination is the thing that makes it possible for man to dream that he is better than he is, dream that he is able to achieve. For everything we have fashioned and created in this world was first in the imagination of man. And then by building a foundation under dreams, he advanced the common cause of his kind. So the purification and redemption of imagination causes man to first imagine and then comprehend the magnificent integrity and order of the universe. He sees himself as a god. He sees himself as a divine creature, and is moved by this vision to become like that which he desires to be. So out of imagination then comes what the ancients would have definitely called a certain sensory organization. And on the level of this sensory organization, we probably can place the whole structure of science. For here, with the mind's lower faculties under the rule of Mercury, man begins the integration of his world. He begins these projects of the mind which seem important to him, but which in the universe are probably totally unimportant. They are important only for what they can do for man and not for what they can do for the universe. But gradually, science organizes sense perception. It takes the sensory perception away from the superficial and the obvious, organizes it, tests it, tries it, disciplines it, until finally man develops what we may term a scientific method, an orderly procedure for the cultivation of those things which he has imagined, and what poets have dreamed, scientists have caused to come about. And having therefore organized, integrated, and made methodical the faculties of sense perception, man can now use them for liberation rather than for bondage. Instead of being drowned by the senses, he makes use of them to open doors into larger worlds and to carry him forward to a still greater achievement. And in this achievement and in all these problems, he runs against an obstacle. For sense and imagination both run against the obstacle of ambition. And ambition is a powerful passion. Ambition is one of the powerful emotions associated with the negative pole of Venus. It is not ambition just to be great. It is this ambition which is the true passion of the soul by which it is driven. And this driving of the soul by emotion leads it first to disaster and finally to redemption. For it is the redeeming, regeneration of the emotions by means of which man slowly emerges into a world of friendship instead of a world of fear. It is by the redemption of emotion that man becomes capable of being a friend, capable of a pure affection for life, for beings, for persons, for conditions, capable of a humanitarianism which places the common good above individual good, and causes love of self to be finally dissipated by love of good. And so by degrees, man takes love, which once bound him to his own ego, and uses it to release his skill, giving benevolence to knowledge, giving depth to illusion or sensation. So finally, these factors all contribute to the elevation of man and the ultimate improvement of the total structure of human society. Man then returns once more to the level of the Dionysian estate, which is the orbit of the sun. And here man finally exhausts those things for which the sun stands. For the sun not only represents the source of life energy, but because it is a center of light in a field of light, it represents the primary factor of individuality. Individuality is the root of egoism. Individuality is the power of the individual to see himself, know himself, and determine for himself. So this individuality, which was once a passion to be separate, gradually leads upward in its redeeming course until it reaches itself, comes back again to the level of ego existence in the concept of the perfect human being. The individual who has carried self as far as self can go, and having so achieved, and having brought self to its human destiny, the individual must go on beyond self. Man, having achieved the orbit of the sun, according to the ancient rites, had attained his potential humanity. He had transformed this potential into a potency. He was a human being. Until he has made this ascent and achieved this end, he is not truly human. Therefore, he must attain his humanity by passing through the cycles of the mysteries, the lesser mysteries being of those planets which are below the orbit of the sun in the ancient system. Having attained, therefore, to the substance of his own existence, man is instinctively and immediately moved by another consideration. The moment we become fully aware of self, truly aware, we must become aware of the relation of self to other things. A man, having attained to selfhood, discovers that it is not the end, that it is not sufficient that man should be alone. It is not good for man to be alone. It is not good for the individual to simply be himself, even though that self may be a rich and luminous experience. So man continues to expand upward into the heroic state of the Greeks. And in the heroic state, he comes again into the influence of Mars, now upon the ascending order. For of the order of heroes are such as Achilles, a mighty warrior, Odysseus, a strong and brave man, Hercules, slayer of the Nubian lion, and many other wonderful and magnificent adventures. Mars, therefore, now represents a new kind of energy introduced. And it is this kind of energy which causes the individual to ascend to the heroic state. That which was the martial principle of aggressiveness now takes the form of man's dynamic determination to overcome the egoism in himself. He becomes the armed warrior, like St. George of Cappadocia, the warrior who must slay the dragon of his own ego. He becomes, therefore, the overcomer of beasts. He becomes the cleanser of stables. He becomes capable of capturing the girdle of the Amazons. One step by step, he achieves the heroic state, the hero represented by the man of spiritual action. Now, the man of spiritual action is the one in whom this action is both dynamic and internal. It is the action which is great enough and strong enough to break the tie of the ego. And so, like the mysterious story of Alexander, the hero cuts the Gordian knot, and in that way escapes the confusion which binds and holds the ordinary mortal. The heroic state, then, is the state of the redeemed Mars, where it makes the hero of the world. It makes the conqueror who conquers not with the sword, but with the light of truth. It is the individual who has the supreme heroic power to conquer self, and to take the sword of swift detachment and cut low the mystery of illusion. It is consequently this strange conflict of Siegfried the Dragon Slayer. It is the hero self now, as the armed and plumed warrior, who turns upon illusion, and with the pure power of the heroic consciousness overcomes it. In the Greek legend, therefore, those who thus overcome and thereby achieve the reversal of the curse placed by Zagros in the descending order, these who then ascend are reunited to the Demiurgus, Zeus. entering into the Jupiterian state. And the Jupiterian state in the ancient Greek system or symbol was the state of true or universal mind. Here the individual begins to take upon his own consciousness the mind which is above ego. This is the higher monastic mind of India, the mind that transcends thinking as we know it, so that it becomes what the ancients call the legislative mind, the mind that begins to seek for and gain identity with the law. Thus, the mind on the level of Zeus is mind consciously identified with universal law, for it is by law that Zeus brought forth the world, and it is by law that man folds up the world again and puts it away. It is this power in himself by which he is able to penetrate the world and to achieve identity with the laws that govern it, and in so doing to attain the deific state of the higher Eleusinian rites. Thus, this is the law, this is the type of mind that is the pure reflective mind, the mind which in the descending arc objectified to create the world, and on the ascending arc subjectifies to experience the power above the world. Thus it becomes the abstract or creative aspect of mind. And having thus accomplished its destiny as mind, it returns to the father whom it first outwitted, and that is Saturn. And it stands upon the edge of the mysterious world over which Saturn governs, and man as a being comes finally into conflict with the ultimate adversary, time. He comes into contact with the ultimate thing that says to him, you must either be created and die, or you must escape creation if you would live. You can rationalize, reason, and create with the mind, but still you will die. The mind will grow tired, the mind will grow weary, and there will be gods that will take away your kingdom, no matter how wise you are. As the wise Greek once said to Croesus, the richest of kings, who said, I have more gold than anyone in the world. And the stranger said, yes, your majesty, but a man with better iron will take it all. And no matter how far we go, according to the Greek cosmological concept, we come finally to the arch of Saturn, where the keeper of time and eternity awaits us. Man, to elude Saturn, or to evade, or to fulfill, or to pass through this mystery, to escape from it in some directional manner, must therefore face the mystery of death, the mystery of time, the mystery of existence. For all of these things hang like pendants upon Saturn's splendor and emaciated structure. So man finds that he approaches Saturn, that the Reaper is there to gather all that belongs to itself. And as Saturn is the father of generations, and is the one from whom all the seven mysteries of existence are suspended, Saturn can claim them all, take them back one by one. And only that which can survive the loss of the seven parts of the personality can survive. So the aspirant, the dreamer after the mysteries, then comes to the realization that the only way he can save his life is to lose it. That the only way that he can gain everlastingness is to free himself totally and completely from the illusion of existence. This would be equivalent to the Buddhist Nirvana. This is equivalent to the absolute samadhi of the higher Vedanta, actual consciousness on the Mahaparinirvanic plane. So here the being has to make the great decision of the total renunciation of all the things that Saturn can claim. And Saturn can claim everything that belongs to us, including ourselves. But the thing that Saturn cannot claim is that which belongs to Uranus, the Lord of the sky. For Saturn is the son of Uranus, and he cannot claim the father's part. So the only thing that man can take away beyond the orbit of Saturn is the mystery of heaven itself. And in the Eastern tradition, this means that at the gates or on the mysterious rings of Saturn, all forms, physical, mental, psychological, must be dissipated and cast back into the great reservoir of substances from which worlds are fashioned. The only thing that can go on is pure heaven, which means the pure, unconditioned consciousness of man. This consciousness then returns to the great father of all. And from the great father, Uranus, it is restored in due time to the mystery of the constellations. And it comes into another life above the firmament. A life which, as Buddha points out, because it is positive, whereas all our living is negative, is unknowable to us. Because what we call wisdom is only a degree of ignorance. What we call happiness is the least degree of misery. What we call security is the least degree of insecurity. The positive facts of all of these things elude us, because they are all captured within the cycles of illusion, which constitute the seven mysteries of the soul. Man, however, as a pure consciousness being, comes to Uranus. And in your astrological mystery, Uranus is the will of heaven, the divine will, the absolute authority of the universal energy consciousness itself. So man, escaping finally through the mystery of the arches and the arcs, comes to the eighth above sphere, which is the sphere of heaven. And here, as the golden verse of Pythagoras tells us, he becomes a blessed god, no longer susceptible of death. This is how your astronomy was made to become the instrument of a theology, which has been scattered throughout the universe as we know it, throughout ours at least, and by means of which we have a skeletal form in practically every system of philosophy and ethics that we know. This mysterious descent and ascent of the ladder, which unites heaven and earth, as a series of moral qualities. And as our time permits, we will go into it a little further, but I guess that's about all we can do now.